Argument is the matter of Sean Rand versus Breezy Point Lodge Apartment Owners et al. If I'm reading the calendar and looking at all the briefs, I'm going to say we don't have enough chairs on the respondent side. So I'm going to ask you, as you're getting settled, if you could respondents advise as to how you'll be splitting up your time for oral argument, or if you will be splitting up your time for oral argument. I'd say you don't have to split your time. All right, is there an indication of how time will be split, or is just one argument going to be given?
Two will argue split equally.
Okay, and just whoever goes first has to know if they go over their 7.5 minutes, that will be taken away from their colleagues. So we will give you indication of the lighting at the podium when you're out of that time and when you're nearing the expiration of that time. You're all familiar with our procedures. Just remind you each that you need to state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. And you can raise or lower the podium to meet your needs. And please know that we've reviewed the briefs so you can get right into your argument with the little time that you all have. With that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Where's the little button?
It's under the middle.
Aha. I'll manage. Oh, I see.
There you go. I've actually never done it. I just always see people looking.
You have to look. It's got an arrow. There's two buttons. My name is Sharon Van Dyke, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Sean Rand. Of the many issues that were briefed with all of these various defendants, there's one in this case that's central. And that central issue is the fact that the district court declined or prohibited the admission of any inference and suggestion that there was a statute that prohibited the dispensation of alcohol with an obviously intoxicated person. That's Minnesota Statutes 348.502. Declined to allow them to read the statute and discuss it in the jury instructions. And this was error, and it was error that made a difference. When you get down to it, the case was tried between Sean Rand, who was clearly intoxicated at the time of the incident, who dove off the end of a dock into really shallow water and broke his neck, a dock that was 124 feet long, and Breezy Point, which is a large resort that I think most Minnesotans are familiar with, and a condominium association that governed what they call the lodge, which is really functions as part of the Breezy Point resort, despite the fact that it is a separate entity and there are unit owners involved. The unit owners were let out of the case on summary judgment on the basis of immunity, and I'm not going to be arguing about that. I will leave that to the briefs, because frankly, it doesn't matter much about the unit owners in this situation, because the association, the jury found, had no negligence, and hence there would be no negligence on the unit owners anyway.
Yeah, I was just going to clarify that point. I mean, you agree that the unit owners owed the same duty to your client that the association did.
Correct.
And so that's why the centrality of the case in your mind is the evidentiary exclusion.
Correct.
Well, and my question about that, I guess, is I don't see in the amended complaint, and the amended complaint, and I understand pleadings are broadly, liberally construed, but there is nothing about provision of alcohol to your client anywhere in this amended complaint. So why is it something that the failure to then somehow incorporate that into jury instructions and the theory of the case becomes a ground for reversal?
Because, Your Honor, this is a situation in which Sean Rand didn't have a cause of action based on this statute. He didn't make a dram shot claim against Breezy Point, which would have required, it would have had to come under the Dram Shop Act, which is a related act, but not this statute.
Oh, and I understand that, but amended complaint doesn't even assert negligence based on the other statute, 348.502, or just negligence as part of an overall duty when you've got an entity that provides alcohol as among the other services it provides to the public.
You're correct. It was not pled. It came up, and if Sean Rand had gone into this trial, and it never would have happened in reality because that's not how trials happen, and that's not how cases develop. But especially when you're dealing with a plaintiff who was intoxicated, like seriously intoxicated, and at least at one point earlier in the day was clearly obviously intoxicated because his boss cut him off. The reality of a trial is this gentleman, Sean Rand, walked to the end of a dock, looked down into the water right around sunset, which is what you would do if you were going to dive, at the end of a 224-foot dock with ladders on the end and a buoy across to what, you know, looks like it marks off the swimming area, which would be shallower, goes and looks, decides apparently that it looked okay because he knows that you have to look when you dive into a lake. And he walks back and does a shallow dive. There are witnesses that said it's a shallow dive, but of course it was really shallow when he broke his neck. So in that situation, you're presenting a negligence case because of the failure to warn about how shallow the water is. That's the case you're bringing. Your client is intoxicated, but there's evidence that that wasn't the cause of this, although we know darn well it's going to be a defense, and it was a defense. But why would you plead negligence in a statute if you're not bringing a cause of action against that defendant?
Ms. Van Dyke, I'm going to rephrase maybe that question to see how you might answer that. Wouldn't it be safe to say as a matter of law, no one could bring a cause of action under 502, and that's the point that the respondents make, and that if the court had allowed, and that's the response to it, allowed and had not granted the in limine motion, it would become a de facto cause of action without amending the complaint, and for which, as a matter of law, there is no cause of action under 502.
I don't know that it becomes a de facto cause of action, because in order for it to be a cause of action, Sean Rand would need to go in saying, I can collect damages because of this. What it does go to is the responsibility that the comparative fault statute is designed to deal with. And it deals with more than negligence. It deals with negligence per se. It deals with strict liability. It deals with pretty much any kind of fault. Pretty general thing, understanding of fault. And common sense tells you that if voluntary intoxication is a defense, and it is, and the whole gist of, or at least most of the gist of the defense at trial is he got drunk. And he wasn't paying any attention. And if he'd paid attention, he would have seen how shallow it was and he wouldn't have done the dive.
But, and just to clarify, would that not transform the case into a failure to warn to a case of providing alcohol to someone who's obviously intoxicated, i.e. the dram shop, for which your client concedes doesn't fit the facts?
He has no cause of action. I don't think so. This situation creates a tension in what does my client have available to defeat a defense? The guy was drunk when he's at a resort with, that's all-inclusive and these people are serving him alcohol when he is obviously intoxicated. He can't recover from them for that. The jury instruction, verdict form would be specific, I think, in that situation that the only cause of action would have to do was Breezy Point negligent for failing to warn him about going off the dock. There would be no provision in the verdict form for the alcohol. And what it would allow the plaintiff to do is say, to diminish the fault on him.
But the point,
that's how it would work.
And the plaintiff wanted an instruction that specifically referred to 340A-502, right?
Correct.
Well, I mean, why didn't plaintiff request an instruction that was that made no reference to the statute? That simply and perhaps evidence that evidence of the defendant serving him alcohol without any reference to the statute?
Because I don't think that it's an at-fault activity to serve someone alcohol.
Well, I think what you're trying to do is to defend against the claim of contributory negligence.
Correct.
And I guess it could have been a way of rebutting the evidence. So, I mean,
that was the whole point.
But you're rebutting it. But you wanted to rebut it with a statutory reference and with a statutory standard, correct?
Correct.
Are you relying on the Johnson versus St. Charles case?
That case helps us.
I wonder because obviously, regardless of what the Court of Appeals said, the district court in that case, I'm reading from our opinion. The trial court indicated that evidence of the bartender's alleged negligence would be admissible so long as appellant did not claim that such actions were statutory violations and hence illegal or negligent as a matter of law. So, I mean, that trial court judge's ruling is not law, but it seemed like what the plaintiff asked for in that case was something different, plaintiff was permitted to put in evidence so long as it wasn't associated with or clothed in the dram shop statute.
Well, and I think it's important that 340A.502 is not part of the actual dram shop cause of action. It's a different statute. It's in the section of the statutes that deal with liquor liability, the licensing, everything. That's where it's located. And it's a gross misdemeanor. And this is a muddy area of the law with respect to how the plaintiff was intending to use this, because the plaintiff understands that under the Dram Shop Act, it preempts the field, according to Supreme Court holdings, for causes of action based on illegal alcohol service. He has no cause of action there. But this is still a statute that imposes a duty on Breezy Point.
And you're suggesting, I think, that part of the relationship between Breezy Point and your client was providing a dock, providing this, maintaining the dock, warning the dock. But also part of the relationship was providing alcohol.
Correct.
And so since that was part of the relationship between the parties, the scope of the duty owed by Breezy Point would include being responsible about providing alcohol, and that's what this statute addresses.
Our argument. It goes with the innkeeper's duty argument that ends up getting, kind of the tail of the dog in this whole appeal. And Breezy Point is an alcohol licensee. That's undisputed. Breezy Point is an innkeeper. That's undisputed. They have, it's a beautiful resort. They have this giant resort that sells all-inclusive packages, and those all-inclusive packages include, in this case, people who chose to use the lodge as their rooms. They were like apartments as part of the Breezy Point Resort, provided the dock, provided swimming, provided boating, provided food, and unlimited alcohol. It was a package. And the only part of the cause of action that Sean Rand had was the failure to warn about what was really a dangerous situation, the dock. It wasn't because it wasn't just diving off a dock in a lake. It was this particular one because it's 124 feet out there and it looks like it's on the far side of the shallow area. It was part of the package. He had no cause of action for the intoxication, but he had the right to defend himself in a case where that innkeeper, that licensee, served alcohol in violation of a statute that carries with it a gross misdemeanor penalty.
What evidence in the record would have supported giving the instruction, meaning would have supported a finding that, in fact, Breezy Point did provide alcohol at a time that your client was obviously intoxicated? I mean, I understand about the golfing earlier in the day, but what evidence would have supported this particular instruction?
The evidence that he, at the time, well, early, you have to go back to earlier in the day because all the evidence, direct evidence with respect to him consuming alcohol was that day was the alcohol he was consuming from the golf carts and his testimony basically of maxing out on the beer every time the golf cart came around and getting caught off in the afternoon by his boss. He was pretty seriously intoxicated. He was not only slurring his words, he was not walking right in the whole thing. By evening, like right before 8 o'clock, so there's a gap in time between the end of the golf at whatever it was, 3:30 or something, to 8 o'clock, 8:04. The only evidence of alcohol, you have to speculate that if you want to argue that the earlier service, was not the evidence of the illegal provision of alcohol. You'd have to infer or have some evidence that in that window between the end of the golf and him getting cut off and when he did the dive, that he had somehow gotten, been drinking other alcohol. The only evidence that would support that would be the evidence in one of the rooms there was alcohol on the table. But the room was occupied by 9 of his co-workers, as well as him. There's no evidence that he drank any of that at that time. And so the evidence, the inferences would be based on the intoxication that getting the beer when he was stumbling and slurring his speech and that whole thing at golf. There's no other evidence either direction of any additional drinking. And in fact, he was physically showing less signs of intoxication when he went off the dock because witnesses said it was he wasn't stumbling, he did what he did deliberately, and he made a shallow dive. He had clearly was in a lesser state at that time. So, and that's what the evidence is. And I see my lights blinking.
Thank you. Counsel for respondents.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jesse Soggy, and I represent respondent and cross appellant Bassfields, and will be arguing on behalf of all unit owners Bassfields, Menk, and Haseman. I do have arguments prepared in response to the other issues on appeal and our cross appeal, but based on counsel's opening remarks, I believe she's alluded to the fact that the issue is moot against the unit owners based on the jury's finding regarding the association. And so I'm pleased to continue our arguments if the court is inclined. Otherwise, I will remit the remaining time to counsel for the resort.
Questions? We don't have any questions of you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. Thank you, counsel. Victor Lund on behalf of Breezy Point Resort. And everyone knows Breezy Point Resort is in the Brainerd area. It's been there for decades. It provides lodging, golf, water activities, and it serves alcohol. It is a duly licensed vendor. It does provide the package of the all-inclusive package. Council referred to it once as the all-inclusive package and also referred to it as the unlimited alcohol package. It is not unlimited alcohol. Breezy Point is a duly licensed vendor. It observes times of service and it observes places of service. You can only get alcohol at designated places in Breezy Point in the resort. And there are limits on what you can get at any time. It's limited to two beers.
Do you agree that as a liquor vendor licensed to provide liquor that 340A.502 applies to Breezy Point?
Oh, sure, it applies to Breezy Point, but that doesn't answer the question of whether there is any private civil negligence cause of action that flows from .502. And it's my position, of course, that it doesn't. The single theory, as the court pointed out in plaintiff's complaint, is negligent failure to warn. There is nothing in the complaint about service of alcohol. There is nothing there. Alcohol is, of course, a part of the story at trial. There was testimony about consumption of alcohol. You couldn't get around it. It's just part of the story.
Counsel, can you respond to the point appellant makes that one can provide the instruction pursuant to that statute without implicating a cause of action simply and as part of the, and maybe consistent with this court's opinion that we referenced earlier, Johnson versus St. Charles, the fact that obviously once intoxication is the defense, that somehow some instruction would better inform the jury of that aspect as opposed to the concession that's not a cause of action?
Well, I take it that the Johnson case means that if the defendant raises intoxication as a defense, that may open the door to evidence evidence of over-service. However, I think the more important authority is what I cited and relied on, Robinson v. Lamont. The Johnson case is a Court of Appeals decision in which the discussion about opening the door, I think, is dicta. That's not the law of Minnesota. Robinson v. Lamont is the law of Minnesota, and the Supreme Court there considered prior case law, I think case law going back to statehood, and held, as it had held previously, that a voluntarily intoxicated adult has no claim against a vendor of alcohol for arising out of the service of alcohol, whether it's over-service or not.
But is there a difference between creation of a private cause of action and a determination that evidence of providing alcohol to an obviously intoxicated person is relevant to a duty of care that already exists? And well, we know there's a duty of care between Breezy Point and Mr. Rand. Why wouldn't the fact of alcohol provision be relevant to that duty that already exists?
Because the Supreme Court says that there is no such cause of action in Minnesota. A voluntarily intoxicated adult has no claim against the vendor. That's been the law since statehood. There's no claim in favor of the voluntarily intoxicated adult under the dram shop statute, and I think that's conceded here, but there's also no claim under the common law, under negligence, any common law theory. That's what the court held in Robinson. The claim, the court said, was unknown at the common law. It simply didn't exist. I don't know what appellant is asking for here other than a civil negligence remedy against Breezy Point because of service of alcohol. And that's the claim that Robinson says does not exist. There is no such thing. And that's why the Johnson Court said that evidence of service when the plaintiff was obviously intoxicated was irrelevant. The court refused to allow the evidence. It was pointless.
Well, it allowed some evidence so long as appellant did not claim that such actions were statutory violations and hence illegal or negligent as a matter of law.
Yeah, so that's
what the trial court allowed.
Yeah, that's the dicta. I think the trial court said it would consider allowing that evidence if the defendant had opened the door, but the defendant didn't and the evidence didn't come in. That's my reading of the case. And that gets to another point about intoxication as a defense here. We read it in the appellant's brief, and we heard it in the argument, intoxication being a defense. I deny that I raised Mr. Rand's intoxication as a defense at trial. I didn't want to take any risk of opening the door under the Johnson case. I did not raise his intoxication as a defense. I didn't need to. The association was another defendant, and they were a party, and they were entitled to raise the defense of intoxication, and they did it very well. But I did not raise intoxication as a defense.
Arguably, you didn't have to if one of the other defendants did. I mean,
correct.
Right?
Correct.
So it's in the case.
Oh, sure, it's in the case. But I didn't want to open the door, so I didn't go there. We have the other issue of whether Section 502.340A.502 should be a statutory standard of care in a negligence action. I think that this runs afoul of the Robinson case. The court held that the voluntarily intoxicated adult has no claim against a vendor arising out of the service of alcohol. And we don't get there through Section 502 as the statutory standard of care in a negligence action. That's the same thing as what Robinson said wouldn't exist. Robinson said that, or they declined to find a cause of action in favor of the voluntarily intoxicated adult and found that that would be a usurpation of legislative authority. And I think that is exactly correct. And it would be equally a usurpation of legislative authority if that were to be done in this case. Every statute does not necessarily give rise to a negligence claim with that statute providing the standard of care. The Supreme Court has cautioned that they're not going to find a private cause of action under any statute if the statute doesn't itself so provide. And in the case of a provision of alcohol, the legislature has plainly provided shown that they don't want a cause of action in favor of a voluntarily intoxicated adult. They've never amended the statute to so provide, in spite of the court's ruling that the court's interpretation that the existing statute does not create such a cause of action. The legislature has never amended the statute to so provide. The legislature has tinkered with the statute to expand the scope of it in other ways, but never along these lines. A statute may provide a standard of care if there's a showing that the plaintiff is one of the class of people that is intended to be benefited by that statute. And voluntarily intoxicated adults have never been in the class of people intended to be benefited by the dram shop statute. So I rely on Robinson. I think that that is the decision that is that disposes of the case. There just is no claim under these circumstances. There is no claim, no negligence claim, no common law claim arising out of service or even over-service of alcohol. It simply does not exist. It would be for the legislature to correct it or to create it if that were to be done, but they haven't done so. And secondly, it is my position that but plaintiff failed to make a showing on the facts anyway. If the trial court had ruled differently on the motion in limine, I would have brought a motion for a directed verdict on that. There is no showing of any service in this case sometime in the mid-afternoon, in the middle of the afternoon golf round. Counsel's statement about Mr. Rand's state of intoxication in the middle of the afternoon round of the golf game, I believe are inaccurate. I wish the court would read the record. It's all there in the deposition transcripts. It was the three Canadian co-workers, his boss, the manager, and a co-worker. That's all the testimony there is. Plaintiff didn't call anybody else. It didn't call any of the servers who were operating the one golf course, which was in operation that day, serving 36 holes on two golf courses. Didn't call any of the wait staff in any of the bars.
Am I correct in understanding that some of this evidence is not in the record because of the district court's ruling? I mean, the district court not only ruled that it would not instruct the jury in the manner requested, but also that some of the evidence plaintiff wanted to offer was inadmissible?
I don't think that that's correct. I don't know what evidence...
Please correct me or help me understand that.
The only evidence on service of alcohol was the deposition transcripts of the three Canadian co-workers.
Right, but did the plaintiff request to put in additional evidence, which was deemed inadmissible?
No. Okay. The plaintiff did not do so.
So this issue is solely a matter of jury instructions, really?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's correct. Another witness that the plaintiff didn't call is a toxicologist. Usually, if you want to prove up a claim based on service of alcohol, you have to call a toxicologist who will look at the deposition testimony and say, yeah, the guy would have been acting like this at such and such a time. But there wasn't one. No toxicologist was ever named. There was a toxicologist called by the association, not by me, but that's all there was. Getting back to the deposition transcripts of the three Canadian co-workers, I assert that the transcripts do not say what counsel told the court they said about his state of intoxication. They didn't see much. The boss cut him off based on seeing not much. Mr. Amsler saw pretty much nothing at all. And Mr. Tellier saw nothing at all. So it's my position that there's no showing, no proof of any sort of claim arising out of service alcohol based on the facts, and the district court was manifestly correct in granting the motion in limine to preclude any such arguments or inferences. The claim just does not exist as a matter of law. There is no such claim in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Van Dyke, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Based on the argument what we've just heard, which is a statement over and over again that there's no claim in Minnesota by an obviously intoxicated adult against a vendor, I can't emphasize enough that plaintiffs aren't asking to make one. The issue here is how can you deprive a plaintiff of the ability to rebut testimony and argument that pounds on the fact that he's obviously intoxicated, so he's all at fault. He would have, and the jury's verdict, you know, enforces the fact that this is what they believed. They found Breezy Point negligent, and if you look at the question that they were asked, it was negligent because of failure to warn about the shallowness in the water. It was very specific. And that's one of the things that would have made allowing the evidence of the intoxication and evidence that was not put in, because there'd always been a ruling that testimony or argument that defendants were somehow negligent as a result of the service of alcohol is inadmissible.
So do you disagree with
Mr.
Disagree.
Lund?
So there was evidence that was proffered or intended to be offered, which was excluded?
Intended to be offered.
And what was that evidence?
Can you
describe the summarize that body of evidence?
There was no offer proof in that regard, but there was definitely the way the case would have been tried would have been a bit different because it would have been focused by the plaintiff's attorney on other people, servers and that type of thing that would have seen what was going on, and certainly the ability to call, for instance, the boss who testified in his deposition. He's the one to cut him off. And he saw things, and he saw who was serving, and it wasn't disputed that the alcohol was coming from the golf cart. And it wasn't disputed that he was taking the maximum each time.
Did plaintiff propose an instruction in writing, or is this simply was it discussed orally at the instructions conference?
It was discussed orally. The matter was briefed. The motions were briefed, and those briefs are in the record.
I guess I'm wondering, with respect to an instruction, I mean, was there an instruction that was reduced to writing, either as a proposed instruction or...
In terms of what was proposed?
I mean, particular language was proposed in a certain form?
To my knowledge, there's not. Because the ruling on the motion in limine was done early. I mean, the judge was very specific. She said no testimony or argument.
Was there a hearing on the motion in limine? I didn't find a transcript.
I don't recall that there was a transcript.
I think there is a transcript.
Looking in the appellate record, I did not see a transcript of a hearing in the time frame prior
correct,
to the ruling.
I'm assuming
it would have been shortly before the order was issued.
It was before,
could be that transcript wasn't ordered.
There probably was one taken, but I don't know that I've read it.
Would you agree that our standard of review for this issue is abuse of discretion?
It is definitely a discretionary call with respect to evidence admissible or not generally, but to the degree that this decision is based on a belief that the plaintiffs were trying to make a claim and that the law does not allow it, that it's a legal decision that she made, and that was what was argued.
But jury instructions generally are a matter of discretion.
They are a matter of discretion so long as they accurately reflect the state of the law. And our position at this, with respect to whether or not a plaintiff isn't allowed to have an instruction to put in a statute to talk about that duty, and is deprived of the ability to do that, to defend, that is legal, and that is an issue that has not been decided. The closest you get is in the Johnson case. And I would say that to say that the door was not opened is just simply incorrect, because Breezy Point raised the defense in its answer. It's been in the, you know, they raised that since day one in the case. They referenced it in opening. They referenced it in closing. No, they didn't pound the table with it the way the association did, and they did not call the toxicologist. Dr. Apple was called by the association, and they did indeed kind of, you know, maybe wisely from their perspective, ride the coattails of that. But to say that it wasn't, that the door had not been opened, simply does not describe the way this case was tried. Thank you.
Thank you all for your helpful arguments and briefs. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. Our next case will be presented by interactive video, so we will take a recess. We are ready to proceed with that.
Please rise.